My name is Matthew Elteringham. I'm from the BBC's training arm, the BBC Academy. But before that, about 10 years ago this month, set up the BBC's UGC Hub operation. This was off the back of the Asian tsunami and just ahead of the 7/7 terror attacks in London, which was the beginning of the kind of the modern era of the use of user-generated content. I think we can we sort of proudly say that we were the first amongst what is now very many who are using user-generated content in their daily output, and indeed the human rights researchers and workers are using it very extensively as well. So it's great to have a very distinguished panel to discuss some of the issues around the use of user-generated content in war reporting and research. To my left, we've got George Sargent, who works in this on a daily basis for Reuters. Fergus Bell, who used to be his oppo at AP, but now works for a startup called Social Asset Management, which is all about working with newsrooms and building software to help them in the verification process. Fergus, as I think he'll probably talk a little bit more about, it is also part of the Online News Association's Ethics Committee and is working on building a strategy, an ethical strategy around the use of user-generated content. We then have Gavin Rees, who's the director of the DART Centre Europe, which is a really important operation that supports discussion and training on the effective reporting of conflict and trauma. We have Christoph Kirtler, who is an advisor to Amnesty International on technology and human rights. And last but by no means least, Wendy Betts, who's director of a fascinating project called Eyewitness, which is all about human rights investigation. So we're going to start this with a brief talk, a brief heads up from each of the panelists, 2 or 3 minutes on the key issues. And then we'll have a bit of a discussion around the table, then hopefully open it up to you guys to engage in whatever issues and questions you feel we haven't yet tackled. So we're going to start with George. George, Reuters, how do you use generated content?
We use it quite a lot, and it's obviously a massive, massive part of our storytelling now. Just to give an outline of what I do, I'm basically a social media producer, so I sit in London with a couple other people and spend a lot of time monitoring different conflicts, building up lists on people in Iraq or Syria, Yemen or Ukraine or whatever else is going on. And we try and get the latest videos and pictures coming out of those conflicts and try and verify them, geolocate them, and get permission to use them. So we also have people in Lebanon and Jordan who are dedicated social media producers. But the bureaus that we have, we're fortunate enough to have all around the world, also have innate knowledge about stuff that's going on online, and they have the skills of social media news gathering as well. But I'm basically dedicated to that and to reporting faithfully what's going on, you know, through social media stuff. I think Rina mentioned she wanted me to say like an example of stuff that we've done.
Give me
in the
an
past.
Example of the kind of work that you do.
Well, like last year when IS were first making their way down Iraq and parts of Syria, there was a video that appeared online which was said to show them parading Iraqi army hardware through the city of Baiji. And, you know, it wasn't verified, and we discussed it, and the general conclusion was that we couldn't use it. But I had a little look through it, and there was two things in the video that I could actually use to to geolocate it. And I paused it, and there you'd see that there's like a telephone or a TV tower. And the TV tower had two large satellites on it and then one small one on the other side of the TV tower. And as a lot of other people do, I went on to Panoramio, which is a site where if you take a photo and it has a geolocation ID on it, it will stay and save itself on Panoramio. And I saw that the stages of where this tower had been built and where the satellites were positioned, and that the colour scheme from the top went red, white, red, white, red, white. And there was also a central section and some lampposts that identified it as Baiji. And obviously we hadn't seen IS, they had their flags, we hadn't seen them there before, so we could say, yes, this is Baiji. It's over the past today or yesterday, according to reports on the ground, so we were able to use that video due to, you know, geolocating. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. Very excellent. We'll come back to some of those issues around verification in a short while. Fergus.
Yes. I'm going to attempt to talk to you about UGC ethics in 180 seconds, so I might talk quite quickly. So UGC ethics is something that a lot of people are scared of because they think that it might be very difficult or that they won't be able to do it in their newsroom. But UGC ethics, it works if you're a big fish in a small pond or a small fish in a big pond. So everything is scalable. When we're talking about UGC ethics, we're asking certain questions in newsrooms about charting an ethical course. So what right do we have to content? Are there ever exceptional circumstances when you might use it? For example, one organisation told me that they break their rules when it comes to breaking news, which seems crazy. How protective are we of our own content? Do we aggressively sue people who might steal from us? If so, are we stealing from them, and how is there any hypocrisy there? Should we credit? How should we credit? Should we credit the source? Should we credit the platform? And then how do we keep it relevant to the audience? And that means understanding that the audience has access to most of the same tools that we do. There's always an argument here between what's legally right and what's ethically right. So just because you can get away with something under the law doesn't mean that you can ethically. And again, a lot of what this is about is acting in a sustainable way, not turning that audience off. So one way that this works, one example of this is transparency. Everyone has access to YouTube now. Everyone has the ability to verify content themselves to some degree. So is the phrase, "this video could not be independently verified," really something that any of us can use anymore? Instead, we can be clear about how much we have been able to verify it to better inform the audience. We've got 60 seconds to go. So we also need to remember from an ethical standpoint that we are entering private communities. We are communicating with people who didn't perhaps realize that we were looking at what they were posting or what they were saying. We have to be open about how we go about that communication and be responsible with that. Also, there's a lot of ethical considerations around assignment versus discovery. So how do you treat content that you find, and how about, and what are the implications for assigning people to capture content for you? For example, if you do a shout out, "Hey, are you there? Please send us your photos of this event." If someone gets killed or injured, are they covered under your insurance? Newsroom safety, which I think is going to segue nicely into the next bit, but you know, how do you keep your staff safe who have been communicating with you know, activist groups that then have morphed into IS? And you need to think about how that is playing into the bigger picture in your newsroom. Also, permissions, and I'm going to borrow 30 seconds to just give an example of what is wrong with permissions these days. Now, the example I've got here is it is using specific Twitter accounts belonging to journalists, but please don't tweet their names, or because it represents the whole industry, not just these individuals that I've captured. So a plane crashes in Kathmandu. Someone posts an Instagram photo of it, says passengers are safe. "Hi, I work for something news. Did you take these photos? Can we please use your plane photos for all platforms? And we'll credit you." "I did not take those photos." "Hi, I work for another news organization. Did you take these photos? Can we please use them across all platforms?" Blah, blah, blah. "I did not. Received them from a friend." "Hi, I work for..." Can you so this person is being bombarded and we're not listening. We don't care. "Hi, would you be able to pass on your number? Or if you can confirm he's okay to run with credit?" hi, could you email me another request asking exactly the same thing? I work for a British broadcaster. Would the person who took these allow us to use them? And then finally, hi, I'm from another organization. Can I use your images with proper credit to you? No journalist is listening to the other journalist, is looking at what they're saying, and we are bombarding these people. Why on earth would they want to continue sharing with us? When we start talking about automating processes like this, that opens up another can of worms when it comes to permissions and the ethics around that. And then finally, on the UGC Ethics Initiative, which I run for the Online News Association, we're a group of people who talk about all of this in a safe space. It's not tweeted out, so we can talk about all of our problems, all of our challenges. If you want to get involved, then talk to me afterwards. We're focusing on the audience trauma, which is going to come up in a moment, and establishing kind of common standards. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you, Fergus. I forgive your time lapses. That was very good. Thank you. Gavin.
Yeah, my first dilemma is trying to work out whether I'd be able to, with a clear conscience, rip off your charting an ethical course slide as a piece of stolen UGC. So the DART Centre, if you don't know, our brief is to promote trauma awareness within the news industry. So the contexts that traditionally we've worked in have been, what tools do journalists need to know if they're going to be interviewing or talking to contributors who've been impacted by trauma in different ways? Or also, what do they need to know in terms of looking after themselves and self-care? Now, I think one of the tricky things about UGC content, and more broadly, the kind of traumatic imagery that's coming into newsrooms in ever larger quantities now. So we're talking about, obviously, beheading videos. People would have been perhaps thinking of those recently. Also, just war imagery of, you know, mutilated bodies. Also, domestic imagery of car crashes. This stuff is kind of propping up in the newsroom now, and it's coming from all angles. So it's not just coming through a set TV news feed. It's coming through social media in different places. And I'm sure you'll be familiar with that challenge. But I think what foxes us a little bit is we slightly lack the language to understand what that is. Because if you're working in a fast-paced newsroom, the theory is that we're just shifting content around. So one set of pictures, we expect them to be distressing, catalogue them, send them down the line, they get processed somewhere else. But what's hard to catch is the resonances of this material. And what do we mean by distress? And I think as an industry, we're only just getting to the point where we understand the difference between occasional distress, something which is horrifying and understandably horrifying, and the kind of distress that turns into something else. In other words, psychological injury to the consumers of the images. Now, in terms of what are the risks, we don't really know that accurately yet because not enough research has been done. We're fairly confident that if people are occasionally viewing traumatic imagery, then that classifies as kind of standard, normal human distress. People have the sorts of reactions you'd expect. But if people are working in deeply and immersively, as a lot of journalists are, with this kind of UGC content, then there is a risk of psychological injury, in the worst cases, of conditions like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, the recent Diagnosing Statistical Manual, which is the kind of Bible of the American psychiatry and also of kind of trauma studies, has changed its parameters for defining what PTSD is by suggesting that people who work habitually and immersively with images from traumatic scenes, and they're thinking of journalists and police officers and emergency workers, can qualify as a risk, whereas the casual UGC punter, the person out there who maybe gets an occasional thing in their Facebook feed, isn't at a risk. So we need to, as an industry, talk about how to protect ourselves. I think one of the reasons it foxes us is that we don't sort of take on board the fact that these images, which are often with very realistic sound and now in high definition, are coming into environments that we assume to be safe. And this is a kind of key thing. So if you're a war reporter and you're working in a context like a war zone, you'd ex- you have a kind of, you know, you'd expect to be a bit hyper, you'd expect to have certain kind of traumatic responses, trauma reactions, which are protective, by the way. It's the way our body deals with threat. But if you're working in a kind of office block somewhere in London, then it's hard to find language for that. So you could have one person who's been immersively viewing traumatic images, and then other people who are, you know, fussing by the water cooler and talking about how Arsenal did the night before. And so the kind of cognitive dissonance of that is one problem. The other problem is the sheer kind of exposure. And it's a bit, it's partly the kind of whack-a-mole syndrome. So you deal with one set of emails and you think, okay, there's nothing, you know, that's all, I've done my horrible viewing for the day. And then bang, something crops up on your Facebook page or Twitter or Instagram or somewhere else. So it comes at us from all angles, and it makes it hard to have control over it. It feels like this stuff is controlling us, we're not controlling that. And the other quick point I want to flag up, I mean, when we do questions, I'd like to talk a bit more about what the solutions might be, is the issue of the single conduit problem. So then some news organisations will only have one or two Arabic speakers, and so therefore that person will be the person who's seeing all of the videos. And that needs to be managed effectively by news organisations and understood a bit better what's going on.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Gavin. So we move now to Christopher, who I think has got a few slides or
a
couple of slides.
Yeah, I don't have a formal presentation, just a few illustrations very quickly. So my name is Christopher, I work in crisis response for Amnesty International, and I want to just share a few insights into my work. I'm also connected to that, want to make a few points. So what you see here, some people might have seen that it's a screenshot of a Syrian army helicopter dropping barrel bombs over Syria. That was the first video that I've ever worked on in the fall of 2012, trying to verify it. I was really excited when we were able to kind of like confirm the exact location. Which I just did by matching up by looking at the content and then on satellite imagery. So really simple. This is what it meant, I think, a few years ago and still today to some degree when we talk about verification. We talk a lot about location. And very interestingly, this is one single video. So I think we really got the methodology down here. Very easy to verify one single video. Really useful for human rights work in war situations. Because a war crime can be one single violation. It gets a little more complicated if you look at other things. So this is the most recent project that I worked on. We released this Wednesday. It was our huge, massive report on Nigeria, where we used more than 100 pieces of user-generated content. So in a way, a sort of like game changer for Amnesty, we integrated that in a huge research report. What we were able to do here, and that is part of verification, I believe, is the content analysis looks a lot at actually who is committing the crime, which is crucial for human rights work and war crimes investigations. So what you see here is you see specific military units, you see executed people and their hands tied behind their back. In one image here, we could identify a specific rifle number that told us what specific unit that is and who is the commander of that unit. And that is really key for war crimes investigations because that can have political and legal implications. The ICC is a jurisdiction in Nigeria. They look at command and individual responsibility. So this sort of information is really, really crucial. And I think one other thing that's really, really important here is that we suddenly look at 100 videos. So if you look at 100 videos, you suddenly can start identifying very clear patterns. And you look at systematic and widespread abuses. If you look at that, you go away from war crimes issues to suddenly you can ask the question, is the Nigerian military committing crimes against humanity, which is defined by systematic and widespread attack against the civilian population as part of a policy. So suddenly the sort of violation and the crime is changing that we're looking at. I think I have around 40 seconds left. So looking ahead a little bit, where do we go from here? And I think that's not unique to Amnesty. What do you do? How do we analyze tens of thousands of videos? So that is something that I'm interested in. What we're working on right now is, and I believe that will be a way forward, it has to be a combination of automated computer analysis and human crowd. What I'm showing here is kind of like the search results. If you look for explosions in several hundred videos, so no human was involved in this. The computer pulls out every single video. that has an explosion in it. So we are already at that level. It's not a system that's up and running yet, but once you have that, I think you suddenly have, you go from 5,000 videos to 50 videos, and then you recruit an army of volunteers that can help you and do the sort of content analysis that is required to look at the specific individuals that I'm interested in. I think I stop here, but I'm happy to discuss everything in more detail.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Christoph. And finally, Wendy.
Great. Thanks. Hi, everyone. I'm Wendy Betts. I'm with the International Bar Association. So already you can probably tell we're coming at this issue from a slightly different direction, although it was born out of user-generated content sent to media outlets. So we were regularly asked to comment on whether images could be used as evidence in war crimes trials or other crimes against humanity, genocide trials, and repeatedly found ourselves having to say that the conduct appears probative of a crime, but unless you can authenticate the footage, it's not going to find its way into a courtroom. So we were looking for a way to address this lost opportunity to use user-generated content to hold the perpetrators of these types of atrocities accountable. So what we developed was the Eyewitness to Atrocities app. And what the app does is record and embeds, at the time when the image is taken, the metadata that's needed to facilitate its authentication when received, and then its use in investigations and trials. So specifically, the app will record the geolocation data, time date stamp, it will record neighboring Wi-Fi network cell towers to help geolocate it, and it will also calculate a unique identifying code based on the pixel count that's embedded in the file and sent that you can then compare at the point of receipt or the point of use in investigations or trials. This code helps tell you that the image has not been edited, photoshopped, or otherwise digitally altered. So then once the user has captured the image, they can transmit it directly from the app to a secure repository that the eyewitness organization will maintain. And then that helps you verify the chain of custody straight from the original instance of the app. So then once in our repository, we will have legal analysts on staff who will review the footage to look for images that may be probative of an international atrocity crime, and then work closely with the appropriate legal authorities to advocate for the use of the footage in investigations or trials. So that's it in a nutshell. We haven't launched yet. We're about to launch imminently. So if you're interested, you can follow our Twitter account, and we'll announce it there.
Fantastic. Very good. Thank you very much. Before I get stuck in, any immediate questions that people want to raise? That's fine. There doesn't have to be. Good. All right. So I'd just like to take a little step back to start with. And get a sense of just how important UGC is in the process now, both in the news process and in the human rights process. So George, talk me through, you know how big an issue and how important is UGC now for Reuters and for newsrooms around the world.
Yeah, really important. I mean, like for instance, recently with the crisis in Burkina Faso, we didn't have a massive presence in that country and have been relatively stable for a long time. And, of course, it all kicked off and, you know, we're scrambling around. Who do we know over there? You know, you call the stringer up, it's a slow process. So that's when UGC came in really into its own there, because there was a guy who was shooting incredible pictures on his PSP, which is a PlayStation Portable, and putting them on YouTube and, you know, the guys, the techie guys, are looking at the data going, what is this thing? It's PSP, you know. But people have got cameras everywhere, and we haven't got a camera in every corner. We've got lots of cameras and crews, but it really helps us kind of just access areas that we wouldn't otherwise be able to access.
Good. And what about, how's it changing the game in terms of human rights investigation?
I would say from a legal perspective, possibly even more so than from a journalistic perspective, I mean, we all know that these individuals are on the ground and are often the first and sometimes the only witnesses. But from a legal perspective, I think they're there far sooner than any actual formal investigation. So they're capturing evidence that may not remotely be available at the point where a formal investigation would take place.
So this provides a real opportunity now that we didn't have 5-10 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think I totally agree, and I think at the point I tried to make is just that the level of detail we see in some of these videos is just really, really important. coming back to Nigeria, the U.S. and other countries are sending military assistance to Nigeria, right? But seeing in videos what unit is responsible for these atrocious crimes might have some implications on the future use or the future sending of military equipment, for example. I think we would still be able to uncover human rights violations, of course, without the user-generated content. It just makes it much more powerful. And the key here is really to combine it with traditional research. So I have my doubts that video or images alone will replace traditional human rights research.
Has there been a case has anybody been convicted through? What role is
so? And then there are two different things, right? So I work for an advocacy group. For us, it's easier to use this content. Nobody can stop us. Yeah. In a court, it's different. I think one example. I'm crossing the lines here a little bit, but. Thomas Lubanga, the person who was convicted, the first person was convicted by the International Criminal Court. One piece of evidence was him being on camera talking to his army, and the army includes a lot of children, right? So you don't see a violation in the actual video, but what you see is that he's talking to children in uniforms, and he was there at that specific time in that specific place, and that helped to convict him. So that shows the power of video, and that will only increase with user-generated content.
No, I mean, I would agree that would be the example that I would go to. That's sort of the most current and one of the most powerful. There's another that went before the ICTY in one of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Right. So in one of the cases, there was a question of whether the defendant was actually in the inner circle of the leadership sufficiently to bear responsibility for the actions that were taking place. And someone had filmed a Christmas party in which Mladic made a speech saying how much he valued that person's assistance being in the inner core.
So holiday footage is pretty vital. Okay. So does that mean that, you know, organizations are really kind of, you know, stepping up their efforts around all of this?
Yeah, and so also from my personal experience, I started doing trainings internally at Amnesty 2 years ago in verification work. So I think that says a lot already, I think, how seriously we take this. But again, I did a training recently. What was the great part about that is it was part of a traditional evidence and documentation training. So you integrate that with the other work, and then it becomes very powerful.
Yeah, actually, if I could just build on that. Sure. I mean, the technology definitely can't solve the problem. And even using an app like we've developed, there's certain things that will help facilitate with the verification, but you have to have the human analysis because you have to have somebody to verify that the actors who are who they appear to be, that the conduct is what it appears to be. So it helps the process, but technology isn't the panacea.
Okay, but technology is changing though, isn't it? And what I'm interested in to explore a little bit more now is how that technology is changing the game. So Fergus, that's your day job now, isn't it? That you're looking at the technology around the verification of UGC. You know, in my day, you know, we used to ring up people and say, did you take this, and try to piece it together with a bit of basic journalism. It feels that that's changed dramatically now.
I think the same work is still there. It's just the tools allow you to do it a lot quicker. So it allows you to, instead of having to ask someone where they were, sometimes that data is attached to the photo that they're taken. So you don't need to ask them that, right? Because you know it already, and you can spend time asking them the other things in order to get it out the door quicker. Mm. There are challenges that come with technology because people can game it still. But ultimately, I think technology is helping us deal with it quicker, and it puts us on a more even standing with the people who are trying to share it. And ultimately, it also helps us find the content that people are sharing.
Yeah.
Because back in the day, when it was just a couple of, you know, it was camcorder video, well, that would come to news organizations.
Yeah.
But now all of that stuff is out there. We have to go searching for it rather than it coming to us.
So and so how do we find that kind of stuff? And I know, Christoph, that's a lot of the work that you do as well, finding the material.
So I'm a little bit spoiled because I'm getting a lot of materials actually from our researchers who monitor specific countries. So that's their day job. So that includes, of course, monitoring specific networks and local networks to collect that information. So it's still done, I think, very, in the case of Amnesty, very manually building networks, in-person networks. We don't do a lot yet using technology, actually, to monitor and find the content, which I don't think is very good. I think it's a capacity issue in the sense we only look at the content that seems really, really relevant. We're not at the point yet where we actually monitor social media 24/7, which is, I don't think, very good, because we're missing content very clearly.
We have to do a lot of that as well. As actually, it's basically, yeah, it's manual flicking through stuff, building up lists intensively, really, and building up as big a list as possible. And I mean, often I'll have like my Yemen list open on TweetDeck, and then just be looking at videos, and then just be getting rid of the retweets, and just try and find the earliest versions of stuff. I think some people are trying to kind of make it more technological to find these videos by running their lists, which they've manually put together, through algorithms that kind of send them a notification when certain words keep popping up. But I think that's very much in kind of early stages. But there's no substitute for human for just going through it. Like as Fergus was saying, verifying, getting permission through emails or just automated things, you can make big mistakes. And there are lots of the old school techniques are absolutely essential for social media news gathering, and calling someone up and talking to them is just still the best way. Because even if you send someone an email saying, "Oh, did you take this? When? Where?" and with a permission, and they might just say yes. If you call someone up, you can hear a kind of a tone in their voice. They say they're on the ground, but you can't hear any, can't hear any traffic, or they're obviously inside. "Yes, I'm there now." "Well, where do you live? Do you live nearby?" That kind of stuff. You need to be talking to someone, really.
I just one point on that. I do think that there is a tendency to assume that to go into this thinking that people are lying to us, or that we have to verify their false claims. Well, actually, I think it's more helpful to go into it thinking that most people tell the truth and we just need to confirm the details. So what I don't want to see is us thinking that citizen journalists are the enemy that we have to battle against in order to get the news out, which when we're confronted with a lot of tools and a lot of and we hear the worst cases come up more often, we forget that people are genuinely trying to share their news with us, or human, or and in the same way, human rights content.
No, sure, but I mean, and as a mainstream news organisation, we have to get it right, though, don't we?
Yeah, but it's about validation rather than,
I think. Well, I'm certain what's been stressed on me several times is that there's the integrity of the company, of Reuters, it cannot be risked for any video. So if there's any doubt, you just don't do it, basically. So that's, especially with social media, you have to build a reputation, and there's no video is worth losing that reputation.
I think which is, of course, very similar for us. It's not so much maybe about reputation, it's just all we have is accuracy. So if we get it wrong, we really do a lot of damage to our cause. So I agree we have to be extremely careful, but I also agree that it's not that we verify every single video, which is not necessary, I think. So we can say, we did our due diligence, and this video did not appear online before that specific video, right? So that doesn't mean it's verified, but we are very clear what we have done, and we are not at risk that we got it wrong, because if there's an older video, we say, we expected that potentially.
So this is the transparency point that Fergus was talking about earlier, sort of showing your workings.
Yeah, so that is really something that's very important for me. So I have a website called citizenevidence.org where I put out all my methodology and all the stuff that I'm doing, because I noticed a lot of people don't talk so much how they do it. So I came more from a capacity building and training perspective, but I thought it's also very important to be transparent, because in the way we want to be able, we want to put us in a position that somebody else can repeat the research, right? It's a little bit a scientific standard, I would say. So it's very, very important, I think, to be super transparent.
Can I just quickly come in? Because I think it's an interesting question, isn't it, about the issue about motivations, about from the content creators. And it's, I think, mostly up to now I've been talking about somebody who's sort of haplessly there and happens to see something horrible. But the motivations of perpetrators is very important for us to understand if we're going to kind of work out agile ways of dealing with things like beheading videos or other kinds of ISIS propaganda films. Because the big point about it is that there's one horrible act of central violence which happens to the people who've been filmed in the film, either being tortured or, in worst cases, killed. But there's also a secondary wave of intended violence, and that's to the viewer. So these people are making this stuff because they actually want to get in people's heads in a different way to achieve various political purposes. And it's extremely effective. I mean, one of the things that trauma does, or seeing traumatic imagery, is it just closes down your creative thinking capability. I mean, people have done lots of experiments with showing traumatic images to students and then giving them creative writing tests, and they come out much worse than if they'd been seeing, you know, pictures of landscapes and green trees before doing the tests. And so there's a whole thing about how we understand the motivations of the perpetrators, because one of the challenges about dealing with this stuff is that, particularly if you've got somebody who's working on a social media desk and they're following somebody like, say, for instance, Jihadi John, and they're almost kind of developing a kind of intimate relationship, like a, you know, gumshoe detective in a TV program who kind of has a mirror existence by following the perpetrator. So there's often very powerful forms of identification once you explore somebody's social network, you talk to their family members, perhaps. It ain't just the stuff that the UGC were putting out there. It's all of the human connections behind the story that we need to factor in order to understand, you know, why sometimes we're not doing so well with this stuff. How is it getting into us?
And that's really interesting, because I wanted to ask you, I mean, the way that IS use social media and you know, IS generated content is quite dramatic. I mean, is the game changing? Are they changing the game in the way that they operate, do you think?
Well, they're very, very effective. I mean, I think the thing that a lot of people who aren't looking at this stuff don't appreciate is how well it works as a form of propaganda. So if you take the horrible film of the Jordanian pilot being burned alive, the thing that gets mostly reported on, unless you're rash enough to actually watch the whole thing, I don't recommend it, is the final sequence, which is shot famously like a Hollywood film. But what's not reported so much is that up to that point, there are lots of images of dead babies that are interwoven into a kind of documentary drama info type format, the implication being that this pilot is somehow connected and responsible for the murder of all these children. Mm. So if you're a younger person watching that and you're feeling that you're excluded from the truth in different ways because the oppression of the Syrian people by Assad isn't given the political status it deserves in your mind, and then you're watching this image, you're actually prepped for the final sequence in a very, very different way than you would be if that's the only thing that you watched. So there are all kinds of sort of subtle things about the way this stuff's used. It's very, 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 very clever stuff. And they first worked it out actually in the late 1990s in Algeria, and there were beheading videos that were circulated as recruitment tools. Mm. And so this has a kind of old form, but it's now come up in UGC.
Yes, they've developed a new level. I don't know if anybody else on the panel has a view about that.
I would say that I agree. They also changed the method by which they display it to you. So IS changed their Twitter accounts all the time. And there's certain tools out there for journalists which alert you to videos or alert you. And because, you know, you might block one, you don't want to be surprised by something, but the algorithms are throwing up the latest videos, and then sometimes the names are misleading, and you'll just see the video without wanting. And also, I don't know if I believe it's part of it, but there's an addiction, a certain element of wanting to see more or being desensitized by it. And I've been in my newsroom experience, I've had to go around and say to people, please do not look at that video. Oh, but I've seen worse. Yeah, but it will catch up with you. It caught up with me. I mean, I didn't go, I can't look at anything now. Just can't.
Well, it's a really interesting thing to pick up on that. Okay. Is that I think what's happening, it's not really so much an addiction. It's that if you know somebody is doing terrible things and they're the perpetrator, then they're seeking to have a kind of power over you as a viewer. So actually one way that you can maybe get more control is to say, right, I'm going to watch this. So there's an aspect to this which is about bearing witness and the imperative lots of people to have bearing witness. Now, if we're talking about the public, we tend to think of it as, you know, people rubbernecking and looking at car crashes, and it's a kind of titillating thing. But it can be much more complicated than that. And one of the effects that sometimes people have when they watch traumatic imagery is a kind of numbing, sort of anaesthetizing effect. So actually, if you're distressed, weirdly enough, a bit more distress, i.e. kind of putting yourself effectively in the kind of threat combat zone, can anaesthetize that sense of a lack of control. So, but then you sort of do get sucked into it. So it's a very subtle play of things that will be different for different
people. Lots of people are very aversive and can't bear to look at it. And in terms of the thing about, well, what do we do about this, is the key, as Fergus has suggested, is limiting exposure. So it's to think of it as radiation, and like radiation workers, we can take a certain amount, but then we just have to make sure that when our badge is about to turn black, is that we just say, right, okay, I'm going to do something else, and I'm going to change my work patterns. So if I was a photographer working in a, you know, in a combat area, I, as much as possible, make damn sure that I didn't look at traumatic imagery just before going to bed, because it's more likely to populate my sleep. I get disturbed sleep, I get tired, I get distressed. And also to think about language. So people need to know that actually having nightmares after this stuff and maybe waking up and feeling that it's happening to oneself can be a normal reaction to this abnormal material. You know, there is. It doesn't mean people are going crazy. The issue is that if over a long period of time people are having, you know, repeated nightmares that they can't get away from, and other areas of their life are changing dramatically, like they're not reaching out to people, they're retreating from social events, they're constantly on edge, that's a problem. Looking at a horrible film and feeling hyper and feeling aroused isn't in itself a problem. It's only when it gets out of hand because we've built up too much exposure that it's a worry.
Excellent. Can I now, we've got about 10 minutes before the close of the session, can I open it up a little bit more to you guys? Any questions, any points, please?
Hi, this is sort of following up on what you just had said. Pardon me?
Sorry, carry on. And there's a lady in green down here as well, ready for...
Okay. But I was curious, especially from George and Fergus, if they could talk about the... warnings and the standards that go out with the sort of disturbing content that goes out, as you were talking about before. What sort of standards do you put out there, and what warnings do you give to the public? I guess could start with George. And if you don't mind moving the microphones closer for those of us in the back, that would be great. Thanks.
Okay, sorry. Well, obviously, we distribute to our clients rather than just directly to the public. And our clients are very keen for us to put a graphic warning on anything that's even remotely graphic. So with the beheadings, it was very difficult because I saw most of them. And initially, you know, we didn't, to be perfectly honest with, no one was really ready for it, you know, because firstly, we were all struck initially with how well produced the videos were. And how they knew exactly what the news wanted to see. So if they take a city, they get, you know, they shoot just general actuality straight away and just file it online because that's what we want. This is IS in Palmyra. They bang it up. But in terms of the processes that we do, we try and restrict it as much as possible now. So only a few people see it. So the person in Beirut will have a look at it, and there'll be a graphic warning on the email saying, here are the graphic time codes between this time and this time. Then I will look at it, and then I will probably not look at those moments. Someone will have to actually play it into the server, but they'll only play in the certain time codes, so that only you limit the amount of people that actually see this. But to answer your question, initially, the difficulty was with IS is that pretty much everything they did was news originally. Because people are like, who are these people? I mean, they're just, for us, at one point, they're just another group, you know. We need to find out more about them. And so when they did that video of, you know, Australian and Kiwi and British fighters sitting around in a circle, I don't know if you remember it, that kind of slow tracking shot, and then they describe why they got into it. And that was news. Now, I don't think we would put that out because it's not news. Then it was. So when they put these beheading videos up, sadly, it was news. So it, as more and more came in, they get more and more and more trimmed. So instead of the hook of the whole Obama speech at the start and all these kind of teaser things to make it more sexy, they're now getting chopped off and we're just giving it sometimes just the audio and a still and just reducing it. So we're doing a graphic warning, we're reducing the amount of stuff that we're actually pushing out, and we re-emphasize again and again the graphic nature of the material.
Anything
I'm just talking in general terms about making sure that the policies that we set up for UGC are not just driven by one type of event. It has to be able to work for any kind of UGC to come out. And graphic warnings in the case of IS are quite difficult because we might start creating warnings based on the IS scale of graphic content rather than something that, you know, graphic, if people are used to tornado videos, and those might be quite graphic, and then leaping to an IS video. So I think we just need to be really careful when we set our policies on this and how we label it to people and or to audiences, that we're looking at that entire scale and that we don't consider the audiences as desensitized or as used to it as us.
Mm. Mm. Definitely.
Good. Okay. Thank you. The one in the green. And then I get front here. So down here at the front.
George, you kind of started answering a bit of one question, which was, is there a changing understanding, I think, among news organizations of what we do show or report on, you know, in terms of atrocities like this, when obviously the motivation is to kind of shock? The other question I had was, and I'm not making this funny, but actually the first time I started using social media to search for things by location, I came across a surprising amount of porn, which was actually more shocking and distressing in the newsroom than, you know, kind of the images I expected to see, probably because they were just very unexpected. Yeah. But, you know, that you're going through Aiden and suddenly you're like, oh, my God. I'm assuming the effects of that would be the same as any other traumatic image and that kind of treatment comes in there. But I'm also curious as to, because I've not looked at social media a huge amount, but I'm curious as to whether other people have encountered this problem and kind of where it falls in the scale of issues when you're looking at social media.
How much pornography pops up?
In Aiden, about half, and it was
lots,
all geolocated. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, I think you kind of, yeah, you're right. You deal with it in the same way as you would graphic stuff. So if you turn to your Iraq and Syria or your jihadi list on TweetDeck, you have to put yourself in this frame of mind, and I think Gavin would agree with me. You say, okay, I'm about to watch something graphic now. The problem is when you're just flicking through and you just come across graphic material, and then you're shocked, and then you know you have to prepare yourself. So yeah, unfortunately, pornographic stuff gets attached to all the hashtags that are going along with breaking news.
That's when you know your hashtag is doing well, is when the porn starts appearing. Frankly,
I think you develop a skill to be able to skim read though. So
yeah, there's definitely.
I never noticed. I stopped noticing it because I just eliminated it.
Yeah, there are ways of dealing with it. What you don't want to do is when someone sends you an email saying this is a graphic video of a beheading, you go full screen, you put your headphones on. HD, and then you sit there studying it. It's better to reduce the screen size, put it in mute, and just look at the edge of the picture. That's what I do now. So I just have a look, and I flick through. Okay, no, we can't use that. You know, I'm aware of it, but when you study it and you take it in, then it kind of imprints itself on your memory, and you know it can. You can the effects can happen afterwards.
I mean, there are a lot of excellent creative workarounds. I mean, I think my show is at Reuters. Somebody in your team maybe was used. I think when I was at Reuters, somebody in your team was using a piece of cardboard. So there was some of the image they needed to look at, and the rest of it they didn't. So, you know, a bit of cardboard over that part of the screen. You know, is that the same Jeep or whatever it was, you know, somewhere else? I mean, on the issue about pornography, I think pornography can be very disturbing if you're not expecting to come across it. And it is kind of emotionally arousing in complicated ways, and particularly if, you know, you're thinking, well, why is this person putting this out there on their social feed? It's going to be very, you know, undermining. I don't think it's quite the same, though, as traumatic in the sense of there's no threat to life, unless it's to do with sexual violence, which is a different story.
The woman down the front.
Hi. I sort of work at both ends of the scale in as much as I'm a journalist. But I also train journalists in conflict zones. And there's two of the commenters touched on things that I kind of see the other side of. And one is the lack of, with user-generated content, I think particularly when it comes from some regions, is that there's not always an awareness, number one, of the impact that can have, how... how social media can actually, you know, spin out and out and out and out and out. But secondly, there's a safety issue there to protect them at that end. And I'm just wondering, whilst the app sounds a great idea, for instance, I would caution my students not to do that. And we've just seen with Burundi, for instance, I ended up actually running Twitter digital security training on the hoof because quite reputable journalists on the ground were tweeting close-ups of people's faces who were getting nabbed afterwards by the security services.
I thank you for making that point. I think it's a really important point that we haven't touched on yet. I'll get Wendy and Christoph to answer, but I think that whole issue around contributor safety and indeed actually privacy as well. You know, there's a lot of privacy issues that we haven't had a chance to explore because we're already running out of time. And I think someone's going to come and tell me we're going to have
to stop. And there's one other aspect to that too, which is when you're talking about trauma, and that is the different way that we treat dead bodies and pulverized bodies, particularly when they're African. You would not be using a photograph of that body if it was American or British.
Yeah. Absolutely. So a quick answer from Wendy and Christoph, and then we'll have one last question over here, and then I think we'll probably... We've got time for one more over there as well? Yeah, okay, one there. One quick answers, then two last questions, and then we'll have to go. Thank you.
No, I would agree. User security is one of the biggest concerns that we have. So, number one, we've tried to design the app itself with a number of security features to obfuscate its existence on the phone. But aside from that, even just including information that accompanies the app to, if it's too dangerous, just don't capture the footage. Don't even use the app. To make sure if you're going to publish the information, then obscure the faces of anyone that might appear. And other best practices we've tried to incorporate as part of the information package around it for those very reasons.
And I think just to be clear, I'm not sure how exactly your app works. I mean, I'm pretty familiar with it, but a lot of the apps that you know that are out there or in development, the way they work is there will be no trace left. That the picture is not on your phone, right? It will be sent away. So you have no picture on your or video that could put that individual at risk because that comes first, right? So we think about this very carefully. Once we publish any sort of content, it's a little bit different than in newsrooms. I think we just don't show the graphic content. We either blur it out or we cut the video off and we explain a little bit what's going on. But I think security normally comes really, really first. So I would not suggest to go out there and attach metadata to all your content you're collecting if it's an insecure environment. It would help immensely with the verification process. It's just not feasible. And that's where we also have some responsibility if we develop new tools, of course.
We talked quite a lot about the dangers of the media showing pictures. But we haven't actually dealt with the commercial aspect of it because everybody's got an earned living. Yep. So sometimes you're going to be pressured into producing stuff that you don't want to do, but you know that the audience is going to want to see it. How do you actually deal with that? Because that's...
Are you talking about pressuring members of the public to film stuff or journalists to do stuff?
I'm talking members of the public now. Everybody's journalists, but when you put something onto the media, people don't want to sit and watch other people drinking coffee. The audience have a fetish about seeing violence, dead bodies. Everybody can deny it, but which news programs receive the most viewing?
I don't think you have to feed the fetish, but also I think that this is one area where the industry needs to work a little bit together to find some kind of common ground on what is acceptable and what's not, and not encouraging people to do things that they shouldn't. If one does, then others will have to follow for competitive reasons. But something that I talk about a lot is how to be ethical in a competitive environment with this, and finding that balance is going to be key. One organization not going rogue and going for the lowest common denominator, but working together to form a kind of higher standard. I think it can be done.
Okay. And lastly.
My question is regarding this like coverage of ISIS and given like all the beheadings of journalists and ISIS hostility towards journalists and also humanitarian workers, media is actually depending really heavily on content provided by ISIS itself, like videos, what they publish on Twitter and Facebook accounts and their recruits and so on. Don't you think this is a bit dangerous, and in somehow my work as a kind of publicity for them, you know, like give them more visibility? Isn't that like a kind of dangerous relationship, because they might be using media, Western media, basically, like for their own purpose?
Yeah, that is definitely a danger, and it's something that we discuss in the newsroom every day. We openly say is this propaganda? Yes, it probably is. But the bar is how else can we report what is going on in that region there? So, you know, for example, if IS overtake gas fields around Palmyra, which is quite important, because then they can actually sell the gas back to Assad forces, or restrict it to certain bases that will be completely dislocated as a result. It's quite a big story. So if you've got a video of them filming this gas of this this gas plant and them, you know, fighting, but then you've got a bite at the end from an IS fighter giving, you know, telling you all about it and giving all the propaganda, I think there's a justification for putting out that footage of them taking that gas plant, but perhaps you wouldn't include the jihadi fighters' words. I think as an agency, our clients tell us, you know, we want it. We'll decide whether or not we run it, but they basically, we have to tell people what's going on and give them as much as we can ethically. I think that's what we try and do.
Yeah, I was going to just wanted to add to that something very quick, really, which is obviously this is very, very complicated. At what stage are we reporting? What stage are we becoming the active propaganda agents? And effectively misreporting the realities, because we're exaggerating the realities in the favour of one particular political position. But I would say that also that we in the media are people who mediate. So we shouldn't be embarrassed about not just showing huge quantities of raw footage. It's our job to find a context for it, to find a way of communicating it that enables the audience to make more refined judgments. And so if we're just showing people lots and lots of blood and very, very scary videos, then there's an argument for saying that what we're doing is shutting down the audience's ability to understand what's really going on. And so in that sense, we have to be agile and innovate and come up with new ways of dealing with this content. Yeah, so putting a context around it, taking the extra emotional sting out of it, perhaps. That's another way of looking at it. The extra factor, the hidden factor that's closing down people's capacity to think properly.
I think that's a very good point to finish on. I mean, the point is you're trying to make sense. You're trying to create a context for this. You know, what does this video? The story might not just be about the video, but you're creating context around the event. You're creating a narrative through it, explaining and analysing what it means and the impact of it, rather than just saying here's a bit of grim footage. I think that's a good point to finish. We're over time. Thank you very much for listening to us, and thank you very much to a very, very interesting panel.